What would you do if there were no newspapers? For an increasing number of people, news is something you get online, not in printed form. Today on the CompuSchmooze podcast, we'll talk to Amy Webb, a Philadelphia-based journalist and online editor who actually spent a month on a digital diet, denying herself access to printed media and broadcast TV and radio. This is the CompuSchmooze podcast, episode 17, for November 7th, 2006. I'm Steve Lubetkin. Welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast. Newspapers are struggling with a steep decline in the number of people who read printed papers. At the end of October, the newspaper industry reported that major papers lost as much as 7-8% of their readership. Online news sites and web journals are responsible for taking a big bite out of newspaper readership. Amy Webb is founder and editor-in-chief of Dragonfire, a news and culture web magazine at Drexel University in Philadelphia. She's also been an award-winning reporter-writer at Newsweek and the Asian Wall Street Journal, and she's been a contributor to the New York Times and Economist.com. Earlier this year, she stopped reading newspapers, books, and magazines for a month, only allowing herself to read online news sources or listen to radio or watch TV streamed over the internet. She wrote about her experience in her blog, MyDigimedia.com, and she's been interviewed on National Public Radio and in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she joins us today on the CompuSchmooze podcast. Amy Webb, thanks for joining us on the CompuSchmooze podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Amy, you are the editor-in-chief of Dragonfire, and you've also engaged in a rather unusual experiment that was the subject of a feature you wrote in the Inquirer recently.
That's right.
The digital diet. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to go on the digital diet.
Well, you know, I've been in journalism for a long time, and I was reporting on technology and writing about it in the early and mid-90s when the internet was really moving into widespread circulation and people were really beginning to use computers in a personal way. And one of the hallmarks, I think, of American journalism is that we tend to be the first people to report on something and the very last to implement it. And so what's happened since then is newspapers folding or merging. The Philadelphia newspapers were bought out. A lot of people have lost their jobs. And the publishers and editors blame that to some extent on the internet and ad revenue being pulled away from the print side of publications and over to various websites. And at the same time, people are saying, well, you know, this internet thing is hype, podcasting is brand new, blogging is brand new, but all of that will die down and newspapers will never go away. And there's a certain amount of, I think, egotism in my industry. And I wanted to find out what would happen if I, you know, just said, well, I'm going to live without all print and all broadcast and basically all forms of traditional media for the next month. So that's what I set out to do.
So you spent a whole month not reading the newspaper and not watching television.
Well, I did.
Trying to, anyway.
Right. I did it. I just used the internet to do that.
And how did that work out for you? You had some challenges getting used to the idea of not looking at print media.
Well, actually, I didn't see that there were that many problems at all. You know, initially, I'm pretty digital as it is, and I am always with my computer, and I have a lot of different gadgets, so I tend to get a lot of my news and information online anyways. Now, the difference is that I didn't have books. You know, I didn't have a magazine to pick up and to interact with. And at the beginning, it wasn't a problem. Towards the end, I was getting kind of anxious. I had some friends, my sister, most notably, telling me that my shortest attention span was even shorter. So I did notice that there were some negative results of what I did.
What was the thing that surprised you the most after you finished and you allowed yourself to go back to free use of print media? Did you rush out to buy a newspaper, or did you kind of say, you know what, I really don't need it anymore?
Well, I think the most interesting that I realized, the most interesting thing that I realized, and this happened about halfway through, is that I wasn't missing information. In fact, I was a little bit better informed than other people because I had to draw information from a variety of sources. And I think we've become very reliant on print publications and newspapers to sort of feed us passively, you know, information, you know, so that we're not actually seeking it out actively on our own. So I found out that I didn't miss any information. What I did miss, like I said, was holding a newspaper or a magazine, taking a bath at night and reading a book. Those are the things that I missed in a sort of nostalgic way. So right afterwards, actually the first thing I did was I turned on the television. And I went back to watching things on cable at a further away distance than my laptop. And I did. I read a lot anyways. I read a lot of magazines. So that didn't really change afterwards.
One of the things that many commentators have talked about in the transition from print to digital news gathering, there's a lot of emphasis among the bloggers that they can provide the news content by being independent citizen journalists. And the traditionalists say, no, you need someone to be an editor, someone to provide context, someone to assemble the content and give it some framework. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it really depends on the circumstance. You know, I think one purpose that blogs serve really well is niche information that is so specific and so specialized that it just wouldn't make sense for a reporter to cover it as a beat. You know, maybe some very specific breed of cat or maybe some very specific aspect of City Hall life. You know, somebody who's a blogger who's really interested in that subject and is paying attention to it and blogging about it, that's useful information for everybody if you're interested in that subject. For somebody who's blogging generally, in the same way that a newspaper would conduct news gathering, you know, the problem is that, and green reporters have the same problem, there are certain things about journalism. And we do make mistakes, but there are certain aspects of what we do that really are learned on the job, and it takes years of experience to really understand, you know, how to do things correctly. And that means talking to the right kind of people to get the right kind of information. When you conduct an interview, there are ways that you ask questions so you don't lead into answers. And the danger in relying solely on what we're now calling citizen journalists is that these people don't, you know, they may be very smart, they may have a great network of people that they talk to, but they haven't been trained in how to present information so that it's balanced or that you're getting an accurate picture of things. I think that people who do political blogging serve a great purpose, and that's certainly biased. And I think people who, again, blog in a very niche way are providing information for the greater good. I think people who see themselves as reporters, you know, after their day jobs, that information gathering may not serve us as well as you know, a newspaper with trained reporters and editors.
How do you think that is going to shake out? Is there going to be some movement to consolidate bloggers under umbrellas of more trained, better trained editors?
That's a really, really interesting concept and idea. I don't know. That's a great idea, though. I mean, if there was, I think in a way it goes a little bit against the sort of open source nature of blogging. But that, you know, I go to a lot of conferences. I've never heard that proposed before. It sounds like kind of an interesting idea. And I don't know, maybe it'd be like almost like a Wikipedia approach where there's community blogging with community editing. I mean,
so,
I don't know.
Yeah, sort of. I'm bringing them along, so to speak, giving them some principles.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting idea. I don't know of any newspapers endeavoring to do that right now. A lot of the larger chains have been working to bring, especially political bloggers who aren't journalists, but, you know, sort of commentary-style blogging. And those people tend not to be journalists, but people out in the community doing other things.
Sure.
And those are certainly edited.
I just read the other day in Editor and Publisher Online a piece about, it's by Emily Sweeney, How to Turn Multimedia Clark Kents into Superheroes. And the concept is to train journalists to provide them with online media skills, to teach print reporters how to produce an edited MP3 clip or a video clip to make them multimedia.
That's not new news. I mean, people have been saying that. I've been saying that for a really long time. In fact, I think we should stop using the word reporter and we should refer to people, trained people, as information brokers. And everybody should be able to, you know, if you're conducting a good interview, it doesn't matter what the medium is. You know, if you're getting information well and you're getting it correctly, that information should be able to cross-platform and be used in a magazine, be used in a newspaper. You should be able to use it on the radio. You should be able to use it on television. The slight difference is that you're getting information recorded in a slightly different way. So maybe that means, you know, when you go out to talk to somebody, that you're using a mini disc recorder rather than a tape recorder. A lot of reporters, I don't know. I always, when I was reporting, I always recorded my interviews just for accuracy purposes. There's no difference from using a tape recorder, you know, than there is a mini disc recorder, with the exception of that a mini disc recorder is going to pick up, most of the time it's going to pick up better sound quality. It's going to make things easier to edit. You know, it's not difficult to carry around a camera. Ideally, out with a photog, but, you know, you could easily shoot photos, and sometimes on the story, raw images serve the story better and the online package better.
Sure. And it brings to mind, and I always bring this up with people who probably don't think back this far, but back in the 80s, the TV show Max Headroom,
right,
where, you know, the field reporter, Edson Carter, I think his name was, who Max Headroom was the alter ego of, you know,
right,
he was out in the field doing reporting with a camera hanging off the side of his head, and, you know, he'd set it up on the table and do his own reports.
Right.
And that's sort of where we seem to be headed.
It is, but the difference between Max Headroom, which I also used to watch, and where we're at today is that the gadgets are very small and they're very easy to use.
Exactly.
You know, and it doesn't have to be always the highest quality. Sometimes it works to have slightly substandard quality, but to have multimedia elements to make the story richer online. Right now, newspapers and magazines, most newspapers and magazines, their online product is no different from their print product, with the exception of discussion forums and maybe a couple of blogs and RSS feeds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not really bringing anything different to the table.
So what do you think they should be doing?
Well, I think they should be utilizing the Internet in a different way. You know, what's great about electronic media is not the fact that we can get it fast. I mean, that's one good thing. So the fact that we can have breaking news and news updates throughout the day is certainly a benefit. On the other hand, you can do things like you can put together slideshows that include audio and photos. You can include multimedia tables. So it's almost like an electronic file folder. BBC does a phenomenal job of doing a lot of this stuff. And one of the things that they do is they tend not to link externally. So they have so much reporting information that they're able to have little electronic files within the site to allow users to click from page to page. And that's something that newspapers could be doing here in the U.S.
The point that you made earlier about the quality not being necessarily needing to be so good, when you think about, you know, CNN and some of the other networks reporting from places like Afghanistan and Iraq with what amounts to no more than a webcam.
Right.
People could be out in the field and be fairly productive with a minimal amount of stuff.
Sure, and there are wireless networks that are open all over the country.
Exactly.
You know, you could be sitting out in the middle of Philadelphia in Rittenhouse Square, you know, using somebody else's network that they've left open, but, you know, you don't even have to be wired to do a lot of this.
You know, the newspaper industry, as you well know, is going through all these dramatic, traumatic changes right now, and the newspapers in Philadelphia have just changed ownership. After going through the experiment you went through and with your perspective on digital media, what do you think is the future for print newspapers? Are they going to continue to shrink in both size and content? Are they going to transition And which ones do you think are going to transition successfully?
Well, some are already beginning. The Washington Post has really embraced a lot of elements that you can use online. And so the Washington Post is certainly moving forward. I think the New York Times is hiring or had just hired something like 50 new multimedia people who are not necessarily journalists to be doing multimedia work with the website. Now, those are the two largest newspapers in the country, and they both have the resources to accomplish digital media. The Washington Post, I believe that the Washington Post Online staff, or at least the non-exec staff, is something like 75 people, and only four of them are journalists. The rest are producers and developers and coders. So, you know, certainly the papers with the resources are going to go that way first. For everybody else, you know, as they're doing that, you know, the Times physical product is also shrinking. You know, so as we move forward, I think it's inevitable that papers will get smaller. There will be less physical girth to papers, and that more resources will be devoted to where the advertising money is. And the advertising money increasingly is moving digital. And, you know, unfortunately, as much as we all want news, the amount of news that we get is somewhat dictated by the advertising money that's there to support news gathering. And that's just the way that it's been since the late 1800s. And until somebody develops a new economic model for how to produce news, that's the way that it's going to be.
Now, we've seen some advances recently in technology that, for lack of a better term, has been called digital ink or digital paper.
Right.
Where they have these flexible papers and the ink.
Right. MIT was supposed to roll something out, as was Sony, I believe, about a year ago. And I think MIT is still working on that product. I mean, I don't know. I was in Japan in the mid-90s and had a little tiny phone that looks and functions a lot like the 7100 or 7200 NT BlackBerry, which is a mobile phone-sized BlackBerry. It's not the big clunky one. It gives you access to the internet and all kinds of other things. I had basically the same functions on the same kind of phone in 1997, except that the phone was smaller, it was less clunky, and it worked better. So, you know, I mean, that technology existed a decade ago, and it's just now being embraced in the United States. I don't know that everybody's going to run and start using, what are they calling it, e-paper, I think?
E-paper, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, laptops are readily available, accessible, affordable, and I know a lot of people who don't have laptops. So there's certainly a gap in our perception level, and that is, you know, how much people want to use technology versus, you know, what advertisers think and their most important demographic, you know, again, because that's where the money then goes. And most advertisers are looking at this millennial, calling it generation, which is people below Generation X, and they're starting to think about that group and how that group will use technology and will use news. You know, and if you ask a lot of people in that group, they're not picking up their morning newspaper. They're going to Yahoo News. They're going to Google News. They're getting news off of RSS feeds, or they're just not getting news at all. They're, you know, watching Jon Stewart.
Right. I was at a conference in New Jersey not too long ago, and one of the speakers, somebody does PR like I do, and said he was trying to convince his son, who's a communications major in college, to read a daily newspaper. And
yeah.
He tried to encourage him to read the sports section of the New York Daily News. And his son said to him, you know, Dad, before I go to bed at night, I look at ESPN online. I put it on the digital video recorder overnight, and I can watch the end of the game in the morning. And then when I get up, I check the websites and I look at all the scores. By the time the newspaper is delivered, I've already spent, you know, 45 minutes reading sports, and what's in the newspaper is old news.
Right.
So, and yet, we continue to hear, and this week, I think City College in New York just opened a new journalism program, and the vast majority of people who are entering these programs seem to be interested in being print journalists.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they going to work?
Well, it's still somewhat intimidating. And the other problem is, people aren't encouraging, I mean, there's a systemic problem, you know. I mean, most J schools are not designed to teach only digital storytelling. They either don't have the equipment or they don't have the people who can teach these things, which begets journalism students who don't have a handle on this stuff by the time they graduate, which begets reporters who are green, who know how to collect information for the lead, you know, and for the nut graph, but don't know how to get other elements, you know, and the process continues.
Mm-hmm. So if you look 5 years out, where are we going to be?
I think that we're still going to be somewhat scrambling to figure out where we want to be headed. You know, podcasting, as you know, and blogging are new words, but the technology is by no means new. You know, again, we're the last to really embrace these things. So I don't know, 5 years from now, we still may be trying to develop a model for how best to produce online news. I'd be shocked if there was a new economic model for how to manage the news as a commodity. It'd be great if there was a new one and we don't have to rely solely on advertising, but, you know, we've gone 150 years on that old model. I don't know in the next 5 years if that much will change. I think what will change, though, is just the demographic and the people, the audience, and how we get our news, how we utilize our news, and where our news primary news sources are. And I think that less and less those primary news sources will be the physical newspaper. And how that manifests itself over the next 5 years, I don't know yet. But I don't think we're going to suddenly pull in the reins and stop developing content for online.
Now, you were a print journalist for quite some time, and you are now editor-in-chief of Dragonfire.
Correct.
Tell me a little about Dragonfire.
Dragonfire is a news and culture magazine. We are totally interactive. We're funded primarily through Drexel University. And we work with journalists from all over the world who do multimedia reporting sort of as an information broker. And then the content is made interactive by Drexel students who are phenomenal coders, have great imaginations, and work with editors and reporters and writers to figure out new ways and new vehicles to deliver information. So that's what we do.
And that's dfire.org.
That's dfire.org, right.
Okay, great. Amy, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Steve.
That concludes our program for today. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please email me at steve@lubetkin.net. We'd be pleased to receive your audio comments as well, so feel free to send us an MP3 file and we'll use it in a future podcast. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, LLC, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.
This podcast is a proud member of the New Jersey Podcasters Association.
Hey, you got a problem with that?